My name is Sudhanshu Kaushik. I split my time between the United States and New Delhi, India. I am the founder of Young India Foundation and the executive director of the North American Association of Indian Students. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with youth activist and advocate Sudhanshu Kaushik. Stay tuned. You know, once again, thank you for listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, and sharing it with your friends and family, and for following along on social media. If you're enjoying these episodes, please take a moment to submit a rating and review, as it's super appreciated. I think we can all agree that, in fact, the best thing that we can do as global citizens is to plant real and theoretical trees in whose shade we will never sit. As someone who provides care for young people, it's my belief that empowering youth with fuel and resources to turbocharge their success happens through advocacy and enabling systems that allow them to innovate and energize our entire society. Now, maybe this power is actually best felt when young people are active and involved at the policy and civic engagement level, ideally where all generations are passing and sharing batons and steering socio-political and economic levers sufficiently towards the issues of youth and the future. For Sudhanshu Kaushik, this ethos has been a passion realized through intention and great purpose. He's the founder of the Young India Foundation, India's first youth-centered advocacy group and political action committee, with a focus on voter turnout, voter access, and youth rights and representation. A very large task, of course, in the world's largest democracy, with an incredibly young population. It's also a task that's been informed and fueled by his own experiences as a youth growing up in the U.S., in the rural South, and then as a college student. Sudhanshu is also the executive director of the North American Association of Indian Students, a nonprofit group that serves to build community for the several hundred thousand Indian origin students at U.S. colleges through a network of college associations across the country. You know, at his core, whether in the States or in India, Sudhanshu wants to make the world a more inclusive place for young Indians by ushering students and youth to engage in political discourse, run for office, and most importantly, to vote. With elections coming in India in 2024, Young India Foundation is collaborating with the Election Commission of India to host voter registration workshops in 5,000 colleges and universities through next May. Sudhanshu and I caught up for a candid conversation about a variety of things, from finding opportunities to reflecting on his own journey to lessons from the ongoing rants and battles in fighting the good fight. But I first wanted to know more about at least a perceived challenge in harnessing the power of youth.
When I think about youth, there's this perception both that there's a natural energy and a profound connectivity, especially with today's youth. Yet there's still a struggle to almost combat apathy and a lack of collaboration, particularly. And some of that may come through this idea of like, where do youth find community? And at the same time, there's sometimes a struggle to even find momentum. As someone who has been so profoundly in a place where you are working with youth, you are thinking about youth, you are organizing youth on a day-to-day basis, how have you been able to meld all of that together? How have you been able to address that, particularly in your work?
Well, I mean, I think for the first time, I've had someone use my work and myself in the same sentence as profound. So thank you for that. Feels good. You know, it's quite a lot of frustration, to be honest. I like to jokingly say that I like to rant a lot, and that ranting stems from something, right? It stems from that frustration. You're fighting mindsets. You're fighting systemic issues. You're fighting complacency on the side of the people that you're working with, and as well as, you know, the others. It comes with a lot of frustration. And this idea of apathy and young people, I necessarily don't believe in it, whether it's in the work that I do in the United States or whether I do in India. And nor is it a generational issue now.
And by the way, I should qualify that there's apathy in every generation. There's no shortage of apathy out there.
But you know, we like to scapegoat or generalize more young people when it comes to that regard, both in India and the United States. Yeah. And I think, you know, generally I call bullshit on that. And I think that's the farthest from the truth. Do I think that young people are as engaging as they should be? No, there's always room for improvement, especially amongst Indian communities, because that's what I work on. But we have to reform our systems. We have to make them more accessible for young people to actually participate. So I'll give you an example. Let's say in India, right, we have the world's largest youth demographic. 670 million people below the age of 25. That's like twice the demographic of the entire population of the United States. Huge numbers. Yeah. We also, in India, have about 90 million people between the ages of 18 and 30 who don't vote, right? So these numbers that I'm talking about, just 90 million who are not voting between 18 and 30 is what, like 1/4 of the entire demographic of the United States. Huge numbers, right? Now, the layman's perspective is, wow, so much apathy. Young people don't care.
And we, by the way, I want to just correct one thing too. I mean, my words were that there's a struggle to combat apathy. So I think what you're saying is that there's perhaps a profound perception of apathy, and that's not what I'm saying.
Well, then we're on the same page, because I was about to go on a rant about, you know, making it more accessible and kind of seeing, you know, if we make the systems more closer, more penetrable, more kind of accessible, then you have more young people participating. That is proven statistically. That's proven.
Well, you mentioned the frustration part, right? I mean, like that's a great intro to that example, where you have such potential and there is such power with that potential. And yet there is this, you know, as an organizer, you have to in some ways kind of think about like what's going to motivate that big gap and how are the structural pieces going to allow for that big gap to get filled.
Right now, so if you vote in the United States, right, voter registration is pretty seamless. You go to the DMV if you're getting, you know, any sort of driver's license, state ID, etc. You can also do it on paper. Very few times would you need like a tertiary form of ID, etc. Primary or secondary does the job. Less than 15, 20 minutes, you're done, right? And sometimes it's so seamless as like a check mark, like register me to vote when you're going to the DMV. Now, the US has a lot of voter rights issues that are coming up and kind of the push from a certain party / demographic to disenfranchise, especially young people. In India, in the US, there's a lot of activism behind that, right? Sure. Especially young youth-based activism. We saw that in the midterm elections. In India, we're pretty complacent. And that 90 million that you're talking about, the reason being, and I was getting into that, so basically just some context, voting is not a state issue in India. It's kind of done centrally. There's like one statutory body that is like responsible for this all. For example, we have EVMs, which are substantially much faster in some cases than most democracies. You know, we've done these technologies where you can use your smartphone, etc. And yet it still takes about 50 to 60 minutes to register one person's vote. You need physical ID proof that you need to self-attest. Who the hell self-attests, scans, and puts a signature in this day and age when... Even though if I need a driver's license in India, I can go and, you know, it's my DigiLocker. And then on top of all this, Abhay, you also need a form of checking basically of your physical proof of where you're staying, right? So it's not even if you fill the form needs to go to hopefully a certain department, that department approves it, then they dispatch someone to go check and that person needs to actually get your consent and your signature. And basically, we're living in a very archaic system and in a time of so much technological shift and change that young people are kind of absent of it, right? And that's what I say, where the system itself has so many hurdles behind it, so many barriers, that how are you supposed to really engage with it? And I wish it was just the time limit and like, oh, the checking. I really wish it was about the 50 minutes and then the secondary proof. But it goes beyond that, right? The Election Commission doesn't take into account that there are migrant students or young people that are going to college across the country or somewhere else. They don't take into consideration young professionals who might have been born and raised in Pune, Maharashtra, but they go work in Delhi, India, right? How are they supposed to vote? Because we don't have postal ballots, right? So it's like, it's very, very easy. And like the ECIs, the politicians, etc., will be like, oh, the youth need to change the world, youth, deshko badlega, etc. Only if they, you know, focus their energies, right? If they come out and care about the world. But you're not making the system more accessible for us.
Sure.
You're not making the possibility to engage. When we're talking about this gap, right? I think there needs to be a more concentrated effort before just owning it and pawning it off to just young people and saying, oh, they need to engage more. I mean, we're trying. We're out in the streets and you see it in different forms. And in like right now, I'm in a very India-centric mode because the elections are happening next year. And I really want to take all that I've learned from my kind of civic engagement / upbringing in the United States and the things that they've been able to do and implement it in terms of civic education here. And, you know, it's a mess where we're talking about a demographic dividend. We're talking about, you know, this youth potential. We have the highest rate of unemployment of young people here.
If I really think about that in the sense of, yes, there is a system that's difficult here and it's got sludge to the point where it's just designed right now to not have young people really fill that potential. And there's a lot of barriers there. So for you as an organizer, I mean, how do you combat that? But particularly, how do you balance advocating and strengthening the voice of those who are young and organize their effort when often the seats and the levers of power are and financing in particular are in non-youthful quarters?
So I think it's constantly a push and pull, but I think at the end of the day, it's about the relevancy and I guess the stake, right?
Yeah.
And I started this off saying, you know, there's a lot of frustration in the rant. The ranting that you have to do is about is how substantial this demographic is and how obviously important and valuable it is to whatever is happening, whether it's in the United States or whether it's in India in our work. It's less about convincing someone, I would say,
sure.
Especially like political leadership. You know, they admit it, right? They know the vote bank, the potential is with this youth demographic below the age of 30. That's why you have the prime minister actually creating and writing children's books, right? About his story, about his narrative. You know, you have a lot of concentration of well-established Silicon Valley, you know, stalwarts who are now investing in the next generation because that's where it's at, right? You just have too many people at that certain point. And unfortunately, a lot of them are woefully unequipped, maybe not in the U.S., right? But in India's instance, you know, we have the highest rate of youth illiteracy rates. We have the, again, as I was saying, the youth unemployment rates are astronomical.
Sure.
We have the highest youth suicide rates. Young people aren't doing too well in India's case, in India's example. So I think that people understand the fact that there's a lot at stake here. I think it's just constantly pushing that narrative and trying to, you know, as people like to say, putting holes in that glass ceiling as much as possible, cracks in the glass ceiling, and seeing what sticks, to be honest. Throughout the past 5 years that I've worked within kind of youth participation in India, we've done quite a few things. I mean, we were taking a stab at taking the judiciary and the legal route of filing cases and trying to see if we could bring a constitutional amendment. We got into the lobbying aspect and trying to lobby people in the government and MPs to see if we could bring an age amendment so you could decrease the age at which you can contest for a political representative. Then we started getting into actually helping young candidates and what in the U.S. people would consider PACs, quote unquote, and doing it for free because we wanted to get more young people into forms of local and state governance because that's where you need it the most. Then we started doing voting, right? And so we're literally, and then we're like consulting with state governments, trying to create policies that better reflect and maybe even creating youth policies that are enshrined with the government. So there's something to implement and hold people accountable for. So we're literally taking a stab at every aspect that relates to giving young people voices, right? Wherever we can, however we can.
I think about the passion that you're sharing right now for every one of these issues. you know, one, does it at all become important exercise in finding priorities, particularly to think about like, okay, well, which rant or which message makes a difference, and what timing is important with those?
Oh yeah, rant is a rant, right? No, you know, there's a lot of mistakes that I personally have made that, and you know, this is unfortunate. I think that we just come from a culture where, you know, if a young person makes a mistake, it's not a mistake. It's an ending to whatever kind of potential that they had. And then I've seen a lot of people gang up on you. Whereas I think in the Western culture, it's like, oh, they made a mistake. Cool. You know, sometimes it's like, no, look at the resilience of someone. They're up and trying. Oh, like, you know, they spoke back. That's kind of cool. Make a meme out of it. You know, they become like, street cred goes up. In India, regardless of, you know, if we have a vice president in the office, if we have billionaires, if you know, we've made it, we still hold on to that very patriarchal structure and that hierarchy of, you know, the elder is the elder. You say something bad, or you say something that's talking back, even if it's not bad.
Sure.
We're you know, we're gonna look after it. And I think that honestly, I've made several mistakes for sure. Because I, you know, I get excited about things. I get passionate about things when it comes to my work. And there's a lot of, if I wouldn't say injustice, I would just say there's a lot of frustration. And it's interesting to see my kind of counterparts in America that are working on, let's say, climate issues, right?
Yeah.
Or they're working on something else related to, I don't know, mobility, student loans, student debt. You can go and be as confrontational as you want, and you still will get credibility for it in that way. But when it comes to, you know, working within kind of the youth identity within amongst Indians, that's not the case.
Yeah, it seems like those the blowback is a lot more sticky in a system that you're working in, as opposed to here, where the perception of that, you know, kind of advocacy or resilience or mistake making by youth is perhaps romanticized, maybe a little bit, you know, more than in India. And I guess, like, I'm thinking of the kind of train station effect, where you have 50 million people who are yelling and screaming and ranting for the same thing. And how does a leader then, either in your position or the leaders who you're trying to perhaps convince, how do they flush out the signal from the noise and really sort of bring about actual change and success? Maybe, you know, in your eyes, learning from the mistakes that you've stated that you made, what's been the formula for success then, especially, you know, to make this kind of a longevity piece rather than sort of like these single shots?
Well, you know, I wish I knew, because I don't think I've gotten there. If I were successful, then you know, we wouldn't have a gerontocracy in India. We wouldn't have, you know, this disparity of international Indian students going to study in the United States and not being able to get proper jobs and not be able to pay their student loans that they've been sold out. So that's not to discount the successes that other people have made in the variety of areas that, you know, people have been working on in that aspect. So for me, I think, you know, it's been I don't really refer myself as an organizer, but at the start of the podcast, you had said that. And, you know, it brings me back to when Barack Obama was elected and everyone thought just organizing was so cool and so in. But I got to give it to
you. What do you consider, how would you describe your work?
I think I haven't really given my work a definition per se. I don't even treat it as work. I don't get paid for it. I've never gotten paid for it. And that comes from, you know, a very privileged perspective that I'm able to do this. And so I treat this as like the need of the moment and my passion, right? I really don't think of it as my work. And I think that if, you know, if I start thinking of it as my work, there are some issues that come in between and kind of convolute that, I think, purity that I have towards this rather than anything else. Because at the end of the day, you know, I don't plan to be doing this in the form itself for, you know, whatever. So if you want to say an organizer, an activist, or whatever.
And by the way, there doesn't have to be a label on it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's okay for there not to.
You know, I'm just a someone that's young, that's passionate about bringing more young voices in, right, through different means and mediums. So trying to figure out what is, you know, kind of successful. Maybe if I did treat this as work, I would be more successful. But
either that or maybe if you did treat it like work, it would actually lead to less passion about it.
Presumably so, right? Because at the end of the day, if I wake up not feeling it, oh, like maybe I can take a day off, right? Like I don't need to. I have that full control, right? Yeah. But I'm in a space where I'm always just thinking about, oh, this can be done. And there's, you know, this is somewhat of an unfortunate situation to be here, where there's always a huge issue that affects so many people that causes a substantial disparity, gets in between livelihood, success, prosperity, that you can just pick and choose. Like literally you can have a dart, you can throw it and be like, I want to work on that. And I say that's unfortunate because that's the issue, because there's so much that needs to be done. How do you even do something in that and feel like, oh yeah, you're doing a good job, when it's just, there's just so much to be done in that aspect. And so, you know, successes are hard to come by, and there are a lot that take place. And I'm grateful to know people who have been doing incredible things, whether it's more transparency in politics, whether, you know, it's harsher road safety laws, et cetera. You know, variety of things that my friends have really been successful at, or whether it's getting VC funding for their startup that's about to change the world in that way.
What have you learned personally, equally about both patience and urgency, maybe in some of the things that you're trying to accomplish?
There's always an excitement, right? Capitalizing on something, an issue, a situation, a law, being urgent, being there, working on the ground. You know, it's like ground zero in that case, right? Like everything is happening and kind of pushing. And I don't think at this point that we've had a lack of urgency, where we're thankfully in that situation. Even my kind of like my team members and people that work with Young India Foundation here, we're keen to be getting out there. We know that the 2024 elections are coming in. So urgency hasn't been an issue.
Sure.
I think patience, right? You get so wrapped up in your emotions. You get so wrapped up in the keenness of trying to make an impact that, you know, you end up, like I was saying, you end up making mistakes. You end up pissing off the person you weren't supposed to piss off in that way, or you didn't know, right? And, you know, it's this great, and I generally don't take it to heart as much, even though, you know, there have been situations where I wish I hadn't done what I'd done. That patience really comes after making those mistakes, I feel like, in the past 4 to 5 years. And it's funny because I say, you know, experience and maturity doesn't necessarily have to come with age. Making those real world mistakes, I think I've gotten exposure to being a little bit more patient when it comes to certain things. Mm. And hopefully, like, you know, it slows down the work, but then it doesn't add more hurdles. You know, I'm at this point where I was always very eager to compare myself to other people and very disheartened to see, oh, I haven't been able to do this, this, and this.
Right.
And I think maybe it's the complacency that's gotten to me. Maybe it's just a reality check that maybe I'm not meant to be that. But I think I have become a little bit more patient with the work I'm doing as well. But it is a satisfaction that, you know, everyone has their kind of journey. Everyone, and I, you know, I hate to say this, but everyone's kind of working on their own process, and the things that we kind of started to focus on takes time, right?
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with youth activist Sudhanshu Kaushik. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Congressman Ro Khanna, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Sudhanshu Kaushik.
You know, if you think about that same kind of juxtaposition of patience and urgency and the notion of capitalizing on your mistakes and learning from them. And yet there is an incredible, you know, amount of work to be done and so many issues that are out there. Did you have kind of any signature aha moments as you were either growing up or in college that sort of cultivated the interest here? I mean, how did that spark happen for you? Where did you in some ways kind of say, hey, this is me in the moment? As you mentioned earlier, it's not necessarily your life's work, but clearly there's been something that's galvanized you and motivated you to pursue this in a way that has brought on the success of really, you know, for lack of a better word, I guess, organizing in both the States and in India. What have been some of those touch points that kind of maybe magnified this for you?
Yeah, I think touch points would be a more accurate kind of reflection, because I don't think it's like that one hurrah moment, one definitive sure. kind of changing your perspective. Some people do have that. I fortunately have not had that, and I mean that in the positive sense, because I think my upbringing in general had a big effect on impact, and that upbringing was, you know, a collection of time periods and just like the moments I had with, and just some kind of context. I was born and brought up in Arab, Alabama, a town that, according to the 2011 census, had 4,595 people, out of which 99% were white Anglos, Anglophone Protestants, right? And then there was me. My family and I made up the diversity. It was just me, right? And the closest was Huntsville, which was a little bit more brown, but that was about 120 miles away. So, like, my upbringing was full of these instances where I understood what it meant to actually be brown in a time where being woke wasn't cool. We were not just by the people, but also by our parents. We were like, no, like, don't do that. Don't talk. Don't do that sort of stuff. So we right. really were able to kind of, unfortunately, not able to express what we wanted to say as we were growing up out of the fear of what would happen. Sure. I mean, it's from a collection of being called. So my name is Sudhanshu Kaushik. They couldn't say Sudhanshu, so my parents used my nickname Sudhi. Sudhi was also too complicated, so they started calling me Sushi. And my last name, Kaushik, my, you know, high school principal thought it would be funny, so he would call me Sushi Kaushit over the intercom. So he could always have that little fear of doubt, be, oh, it was the intercom I actually told, you know, I pronounced it the way I did, right? And that was funny yeah. to them. That's what I grew up with. Or, you know, the time where I really wanted to vote for Barack Obama in the 2012, I think, was the elections. I didn't get to. My first time vote, I didn't get to vote out of the fear, because I went to the polling booth. And it's not that they said anything to me, but society yeah. and those social norms, and they knew if that, you know, if there was going to be votes for Barack Obama, this guy was going to be
that's
voting
the
for
guy.
Right?
Yeah.
yeah, that's the guy. And I like, I remember I went into the polling booth and I came back out and never actually placed my vote because of that fear.
Do you still have that fear today? Like, if you do, you would you think to yourself that, like, hey, that was a different time in my life, and if I had known perhaps some of the lessons, and I mean, obviously everyone kind of does that and they go back and say, gosh, I wish I would have had that one back, but do you regret walking out of that voting or precinct?
No, not at all, because I think it put me into this kind of pathway of being passionate about identity and politics and civic engagement and giving voices. I don't regret that my principal used to call me Sushi Kaushit, or I could have had a chance to, you know, move to another city. I don't regret the fact right. that, you know, I lived right next door to the police sheriff of the town who was conveniently part of the KKK. I don't regret the fact that every single homecoming game that my high school team won, the way that they would celebrate was to teepee my house. And you know, I don't regret anything. Because I would have been a different person. I think that I would have followed a substantially different trajectory. And I think those are the experiences No, I wasn't taught race, to be honest. I wasn't. There were a lot of things that weren't taught. Like, for example,
yeah,
I didn't know what the N-word meant at all.
Yeah.
Right? Not until I actually used it in front of an African-American fellow classmate in my freshman year of college.
Right.
Right? The kind of sand was used against me, but I would always treat it as a joke. Right?
Yeah.
That's what I got really good at, right? Like, oh, okay. So I didn't know the connotation. Until I did it to someone else and they're like, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
Right. And that's where I learned. So a lot of my learnings were actually people to people instead of from like, OK, this is the history behind this is what you do. You know, I know the power of words and I know the power of, you know, community organizing because I went through the situations. I went through either the lack of it or at the brunt of it facing it as a victim. So that is what molded me into what I do right now. Right. And I think I understand that value and impact. And when I think about it, a lot of my kind of like Jersey friends who were born and brought up or in the city or my Bay Area friends, I think we brand folks, like we live in silos, right? Especially Indians out of the South Asians, right? And I purposely never use the word South Asians because I think it's just doing disservice to everyone else also, including people within the Indian demographic. And so I think that, you know, we don't value and that kind of identity, that kind of people to people learning and the impact that words and people can have.
You know, were many of the touch points sounds like they were in fact learning lessons, but also ones that, you know, may have had some trauma. Were there touch points also that were incredibly inspiring and for that matter, kind of accelerating for the work that you do now?
You know, it's funny because I very late on understood the concept of trauma. I'm like, oh, maybe I have that. but, you know, I wouldn't call it trauma, to be honest. Maybe it's just me think of it from a different perspective. Sure, there are issues that has altered the way that I think, the way that I work, the way that I act around people, for sure. For the better and the worse, a part of it.
Sure.
But I personally wouldn't say that it's this trauma that I have. I think just contextually, it's a little off now. In terms of on the opposite side, you were talking about like these awe-inspiring moments. I don't think I've had those awe-inspiring moments in the U.S., and which is interesting. I think that a lot of these moments of inspiration or even like, oh, this is what I can and can't do, I think that actually came in India from the work that I was doing in the little capacity that I could growing up. And that's why I think I'm more passionate about the Indian identity is because as growing up, I realized, hey, this is what feels good. And it also, I realized something that anything that I would do in the United States was a product of not spite, but a reactionary of what had been done to me, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Passionate about voter accessibility engagement because when I wanted to vote for the first time, I couldn't vote, right? For the fear of. And that's why I'm really passionate about voter education and the organization I run in the United States, the North American Association of Indian Students. We registered upwards of 3,500 students for the first time, re-registered, mobilized, et cetera, just in the midterm elections, right? Yeah. Or you know, the other things in terms of, you know, access to proper education, what we're learning, that sort of stuff. So it's all reactionary.
Yeah.
In India, the work that I do truly comes from not just a point of privilege, but also just inspiration, right? I'm always just like, it comes from what can you do better? Not because it's happened to me and I want to better that situation, but just because that there's so much to do, right? Pick and choose and keep on working at it. And you know, this is a very privileged conversation I'm having, right? Like I completely understand that it's like, oh, you know, you don't have to deal with the impoverishment levels or, you know, the atrocities that come with being of a certain caste hierarchy or a religion or that sort of stuff, right? So but just for me personally speaking, I think that the situation, the work that I do in India isn't reactionary. It's truly just because, hey, I found this of interest. I'm passionate about it. I might not have a story that comes along with it about my personal motivation that I could, you know, give in a podcast interview and it would, you know, really look good for a book. But it's more of just content and happiness, right? That you get.
Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah. No, it doesn't sell as much, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you a kind of corollary to that, right? I mean, the concept of even audience that you work with, your peers, the community that you've built, both in the United States and in India, you know, that concept, even the timeline of youth can be fleeting. And, you know, the framework of communication especially gets accelerated in the digital era, maybe even more compressed. So I ask this as sort of a conceptual thing. How do you stay young in order to, in some ways, kind of continue to empathize deeply with the needs of, you know, and particularly the specific aspirations of youth who may actually at some point, if not very soon, maybe in the future, or even now, look at you and as someone who's actually old.
Yeah, no, my team is now calling me an uncle because I just turned 28. And wow, you know, as someone who has made those accusations beforehand, I feel now, right. I know how it feels.
There you go.
Okay, there are two different facets of this answer. First, I'm going to take the more serious approach and kind of talk about it from the perspective of my work. I'm in that age bracket and demographic that needs them. Like I fit in that 20 to 28 when it comes to the census where this is the biggest bulge. So regardless of, you know, how I age, right? This bulge of demographic, whether it's the 15 to 29, the 20 to 29, that sort of demographic where India has the highest amount, right? Disproportionately so with any other age bracket, they will be the, you know, most unskilled demographic that India is at. They will be the most illiterate. They will also be the least prepared in this very changing world. So that work continues, right? It's right now where young people, where below the age, you know, India defines youth as anywhere below 29. So, you know, we are young in that youth perspective, 35, whatever. But, you know, there will be different needs that will change, even though that youth demographic will evolve, right? So I'm passionate about the demographic that I fall under at this point, right? Right. And working towards that. And obviously the people that are younger and below me, but we will be aging, but the issues might change, but there will be other issues that will compound onto that we'll be having to fix, right? So one question is that, because I generally think that, you know, regardless of we're aging or not, those issues will reframe. The second aspect is obviously ceding space. You know, I can't be talking about youth issues when I used to be the one making fun of people that wouldn't do it. You have to cede space. So for Young India Foundation, you know, I'm not the CEO anymore. I don't lead it proactively. Am I involved? Sure. But I, as a founder, you know, we have a 22-year-old who is the CEO, and more relevant to the age bracket and demographic we're giving. So I think seeding space is so, so important. You know, you're fighting for this demographic and you're trying to stay relevant within that demographic. Once you're irrelevant, once that generation has moved on, then you can't just be fighting for that, you know, kind of, I mean, you can be, right? It's like saying, like, I don't know, Ed Markey of like Milwaukee for Boston, the senator, right? Or Elizabeth Warren doing these very progressive, or Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And these like very progressive senses, it's, you know, it's not that they're young, but they're still fighting for issues that young people really value. Absolutely. Relate. So I wouldn't say that.
But oftentimes, you know, when two people are passionate about things, but they identify with someone who is a peer of theirs, when in fact, you know, they may or may not, you might think that you're a peer of theirs, but they may not necessarily see you that way.
Maybe it's time to realize you're old. I mean, it is always hard to stay relevant in that aspect, right? And I see that. I mean, like, we do a lot of college activity in the United States. I see that more actually in the United States. I do a lot of touring in the United States. So I'm in this demographic of 18 to 22 year old and maybe a little bit older. And me being 27 at that time, you know, I whether it's the words, whether it's that, it you see it, but you don't feel it in that way. But you're like, oh, okay, right. Like I'm not fitting on, and they know you're old too, right? So it's like, oh, okay. So fighting for that kind of not relevancy, but like, hey, like we're on the same playing field can be an interesting battle. Thankfully, you know, because of the issues that we're working on, the ability to do the work that I do, I'm able to kind of still stay in that kind of team. And maybe like, you know, in a few years, I won't be able to. But that's, I guess that's an issue and situation that I'll deal with when I get to it.
There you go. Yeah. And hopefully you'll have some, I mean, I turned 52, so I definitely have some work to do that's cut out for me, I think.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Sudhanshu Kaushik. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hey there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with youth activist and advocate, Sudhanshu Kaushik.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you work with youth in both India and the U.S., as you mentioned, and I'm curious from your perspective, what have been some surprises when you think about some of the things that have surprised you about how similar the two populations are? And perhaps something that surprised you about what's been, you know, a difference between the two, especially sure. Given your unique perspective of kind of straddling both of those.
I'm going to say the similarity is the lack of access that they both have towards their respective political representatives, government, and overall kind of like electoral democracy. Now, is it easier in the United States? Sure. Whether it's reaching out, that sort of stuff, I think that's kind of easier. But there is a difference for sure. So I think the similarity has been that, you know, like people, you know, they're not gung-ho about like leaving everything and trying to become president, right? But there is that similarity of people feeling as if they're disconnected from, and then once you're disconnected, you're disinterested. Right. I won't care about things that I feel remotely so out of touch with or people don't care about. Right. And I think the similarities are also just the prospect. Right. In the United States, look, sure, we are what we're doing as a demographic, but that youth demographic proportionally so from what's coming from India as well, whether it's international students, but also the growing and bulging demographic that we have, it's growing. More Indians are on campuses across urban and rural areas that are growing. You have more Indian student organizations. I mean, you know, you went to Berkeley, so you probably had a good time when you were in college, right? Because you had a decent amount of representation of brown people, whether international or not. But you know, I've been to campuses and stuff that in the past 2-3 years have just exploited with you know, Indians, whether they're international, whether they're from here, Indian Americans, and like the most random places. Dayton, Ohio, where University of Dayton is, has over 500 international Indian students, right? Like Dayton isn't, like Dayton is like a very comparatively small city when compared to all the other big cities in Ohio. And you still have 500 people landing from India every single year in a very small campus. And, you know, so I think that you will see just how influential that's getting, how much of a potential there is as these numbers expand. Right. I think in terms of what's different, right?
And particularly not just what's different, but what's been surprising about what's different.
When you compare the two, right? Only when you're comparing the two, you realize how young people, young Indians in the United States don't recognize the privilege and the access and the ability that they have, right? Mm-hmm. And you compare it to the resourcefulness of Indians here.
Yeah.
And there's just a whole difference, right? And I'll be honest, I've seen that complacency grow where in like clubs and like going to these colleges and everyone wants to like, oh, Bollywood. Yeah, let's have a Bollywood night. And that is right. their form of cultural expression and solidarity and like everything all mixed into one is having that dance off, right?
Sure.
And because it's like, you know, we've got the best of the worlds. We've got a family that can provide for us. We'll get a good paying job. We won't have to have student right. loans or a lot of it. You know, like people come from a whole nother level of privilege. Whereas yeah. like, you know, that ambition, not to say that the ambition doesn't exist in Indians in the United States. I think the ambition still exists. I think the, you know, like career-wise, trying to be this and that, I think that's plenty of. So please don't get me wrong sure. on that. But I think that kind of, you know, like hunger, right? That resourcefulness yeah. to, if yeah. not make it big, but make it out of this place, right?
Yeah.
And being able to just do this. And then with the limited constraints you have, I mean, the stuff that people here do in their phones that are like Android, like phones, like, you know, these Chinese phones that are just like terrible and they're doing the world on it. And then like, I have to have the newest iPhone that comes out. And what am I going to do? I'm going to write the same emails. I'm going to make the yeah. same total, like, you know, like phone calls and like, you know, use my Chase banking account app and I need to right, have right. like 20 gig of RAM. And these people are like literally creating businesses and they're doing this. And like, I was talking to someone and India has banned TikTok here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was talking to someone who used to be like a big, big TikTok influencer. And what they're doing now is because, and also VPNs are not working at this point. Yeah. They basically edit through another equivalent of an app that's closer to TikTok, do their dances, send mm-hmm. that actual form of video to a friend in like a different country so that they can upload. And you know, like, just like their resourcefulness yeah. In that way, it's like, it's a very like very superficial answer, but it's like imagine if like something was like, so for example, like if something was banned in the United States, I would try a VPN. If that's it, then right. done. That's the end of my TikTok yeah. career, right? Yeah. But here,
yeah, I mean, look, and the like, few, you know, there's less of this. I'm not even sure if I'm going to do it justice, but like that sort of survival of the idea, the survival mm-hmm. of your, you know, will and motivation. It seems like that's impressive.
And there's no need to romanticize it, right? Like we don't yeah. need to romanticize that kind of aspect. Correct. But it's still there, and it's still yeah. just as exciting, if that makes sense, right? Yeah. Like it's interesting does. from a perspective's point of view.
You know, with all that, and again, sort of your unique position of how you shared, you know, from your upbringing, and now the you know, the experiences that you had, the place that you've had on college campuses, and the work that you're doing with people, you know, in both, you know, places. What have these few years of leading, particularly with youth, whether it's, you know, on that are issue based or organizing on college campuses, what has this actually shown you particularly about leadership?
You know, this isn't the answer that I would want to give normally, nor to anyone, and feel like, oh, this is a very inspiring answer. I think this is actually a very a selfish answer. Yeah. But one thing that I've realized is that, and I don't even know if I'm going to answer this correctly, but it's off the cuff, so why not? I don't want to create cliques. I think that the Indian community, especially in the United States, especially not just in the colleges, which it starts and stems from. It stems from our temples. It starts from our places of worship. It then proceeds to the people we hang out with, the ideology. We love building cliques. Mm. And we love holding on to those cliques. And then we shun other people out, right? Not until someone benefits us, right? Oh, you can invest in my startup, or oh, you know, I can get like a political calculus out of you, so let me do that, right? I've really learned to keep away and kind of in the work that we do to not be able to develop those cliques, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that that's like, how do you even proactively do that? you know, you try not to get into that groupism, that tribalism, but what I think is always in the back of my mind every time we're doing some sort of work or event or whatever, is this accessible? Is this actually going out to not just a certain demographic and certain groups? So, you know, I use social media a lot. For example, I used to do these community nights, right, where I would just cook a lot of Indian food and invite anyone from New York over. And when I say anyone, it's not that I'm sending a message on my friend group. I would literally post it on my public story and be like, bring friends. And I would have random people come, right? Like from that, like opening my house and that sort of stuff. And I think that stems from knowing how cliquish the Indian community is. And I think, Abe, I'm going to call you guys out, your generation. Not even like the uncles and aunties before you, but I think that, you know, this, and I've experienced this, the ones that are at their primes. I would say that you're at your prime at this point. I know that goes counter to like the youth empowerment and youth demographic. But the ones that have really made it, that have those connections, that, you know, are at the prime of their career and success, and hopefully more so as well. You know, they're only looking back for others that they know that can benefit them. And I think that's really disheartening to see. And I wish we evolved from that. But unfortunately that's something that I see is in our culture, in our heritage. And I think that we need to be opening up those spaces. And I personally do it, not just in my work, but in my personal life, like I was giving comparisons of, is trying to make it as open as possible. And I think social media has helped with that. But yeah, I mean, I you know, it's really to call you guys out, you know, like the Bay Area fundraiser group, right? And they have their own nonprofits, and then they have their own cliques, and they'll do the same typical fundraisers for those certain nonprofits, for those certain causes, because, you know, they know one another. All of them are on the same board. All of them are in the same, etc. And then there are groups that are built on like, oh, the power of our community, but it's the power of their community. Right? The ones that they know. Unless someone makes it big and they're like, oh, come join our group, come join our group. It's like, aren't we supposed to be uplifting others while they're making it up? Right? Why aren't you kind of like, you know, engaging them at that point? Why aren't you ceding more space? Unless it's your daughter, your nephew, your, you know, cousin, etc. And that's why I think that's one of the biggest things that has really bothered me in that aspect. And I've had run-ins in that. And then I just stopped trying. Like, I genuinely found more acceptance in non-brown communities of the work that we were doing for Indian and Indian American students in colleges than in the generation that kind of is running the Indian American space right now, if that makes sense, right? Like, I have more donors that are white, that are white grant-making institutions, than I have of actual, like, you know, Indian folks. Which to me is just so frustrating and perplexing. It's not even that I've tried. They know the work, we've done it and that sort of stuff, but they're just not open to it in that way. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I guess it sounds like when it comes to learning about leadership that your main takeaway so far has been to not get into this kind of tribal or clique mentality. And I'll sort of leave it with this then. How has that been in some ways kind of a vehicle for cultivating trust? So how do you cultivate trust among young people, among people, you know, again, of all generations, and for that matter, whether they're stakeholders who are potential donors or people who you're trying to have included in the tent? How do you cultivate trust?
You know, maybe that's not what I'm good at, cultivating that trust, huh? But I don't think I'm necessarily focused on cultivating that trust. I think I'm focused on making sure that what we're setting out to do, we're doing. And when a situation arises that someone needs us. So when it was in COVID, when there were Indian students stranded because, you know, people weren't picking up their officials, their calls that were supposed to go, flights were banned. So when students needed food assistance, when students needed rental assistance, when, you know, dorms literally kicked students out, we were there, right? We were able to fundraise and get a lot of aid and efforts towards them. You know, when it comes to standing up for them, when there are young people that are kind of discriminated basis on their age when it's in India, when we're trying to get them to contest and run for local office, but the bureaucrat, you know, denies them their paperwork, not on the merits of the actual paperwork itself, but just because they're young. You know, we're up there making sure that we get their nomination filled in that aspect, right? So when the time comes, we're there. I guess that's how you can cultivate trust, but that's not what I'm focused on. I think I'm focused on when there's a need, are we there? And are we, you know, there and enjoying the work, and is our work substantial? And I think maybe that a byproduct of that can be that cultivation of that trust and dependency and that sort of stuff.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation, and one that I hope people are going to pay attention to, particularly when it comes to the work you're doing. Sudhanshu, thank you so much for joining us. What a treat, and congratulations on all the work that you're doing and continue to do.
Thank you so much for having me, Abe, and hopefully see you soon in the West Coast.
Thanks again, Sudhanshu. And please visit youngindia.foundation to learn more. Thanks again for listening, and if you're enjoying it all, again, please share a kind rating or review. Until next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.